Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, August 27th, 2018, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's show, I want to thank one of the sponsors of the episode. Talk Nerdy is brought to you by the upcoming film, Kin, coming to theaters and IMAX everywhere August 31st. Starring Zoe Kravitz, James Franco, Dennis Quaid, Jack Rayner, and introducing Miles Truitt, from the directing duo Jonathan and Josh Baker, executive producer Michael B. Jordan, and the producers who brought you Stranger Things and Arrival. This original pulse-pounding sci-fi crime thriller tells the story of Eli, a teenage boy who's forced on the run with a mysterious weapon as his only protection against a vengeful criminal and two otherworldly soldiers. Following his older brother's release from jail, Eli finds a mysterious object in an abandoned building that seems to respond to him uniquely. He doesn't know what it is yet, but holding it seems to activate it, and Eli decides to guard it preciously. When Eli's older brother Jimmy finds himself in trouble with a vengeful criminal he owes a debt, the two brothers are forced to go on the run. On their journey, Eli quickly discovers that the powerful weapon he discovered can do more than just provide protection. It may also reveal his destiny. For sci-fi and thriller lovers, this film is filled with suspense, action, self-realization, and also highlights the importance of brotherhood and kinship. Watch the trailer now and be sure to see Kin when it hits theaters and IMAX August 31st. All right, guys, we've got a great episode today, but I want to thank those of you who have contributed to the show and helped make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember that the model of Talk Nerdy is that it is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because I work with advertisers, and those of you who want to support the show do so by visiting www.patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging your support. This week's top supporters are Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you'd like to pledge your support, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy or carasantamaria.com to learn all about the show. All right, guys, this week it's going to be a really fascinating one, and I cannot believe I waited this long to dive into this topic. I am joined by Brianna Cox. Now, she's the quality assurance manager at MedCure Inc., a compassionate whole body donation program that allows people to donate their bodies for education and research. So we're going to talk all about the body donation process, what it means to donate your body for scientific education and research, and how you can do so if it's something that you are interested in. So without any further ado, here she is, Brianna Cox. Well, Brianna, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's nice to be on the show.
Absolutely. So, oh my gosh, I'm so glad that I'm able to chat with you about this. It's a topic that has always been really close to my heart and that I'm really fascinated by. I don't know if you know, but lately I've gone back to school. I'm working on my PhD after being out of the loop for 10 years. I'm studying clinical psychology, but I'm very interested in death and dying psychotherapy. And I read a lot of books about death, both pre-death and post-death. It's a fascinating subject to me. I think it's one where we don't have a very good relationship with the concept here in the States. We will get to all of that. But what you are here to talk about is whole body donation to science.
That is correct. And I actually did see your background. I think it's incredibly cool that that you're studying clinical psychology. It's an area that I also find fascinating. So whole body donation, I guess, is there anything in particular you want to know, or do you want me to jump in?
I want to know everything. Okay, I want to start with the starting point. And it's funny because we were chatting offline before and I was like, okay, everything I know about whole body donation, I know from reading Stiff. So I'm probably just going to like drill you on all the things I learned in Stiff. And you were like, yeah, I should probably read that, which is so funny.
It's funny. A lot of my coworkers have said that it's an absolutely fascinating book and they want to know how I haven't read it yet. So I'm one of those people who has
That's good to know.
A giant stack of books on the side of my bed. So I'll get there eventually, but I haven't gotten there yet with Stiff.
Oh my gosh. Can I just say, I carried a stack of books that, I mean, I don't know how I got it up the stairs from the side of my bed because I was like, this is not happening. These need to go on the bookshelf. So I feel your pain. But yes, Stiff, Mary Roach, first of all, this is just a random plug for her. I still haven't had her on the show. I need to convince her. But she is one of my favorite contemporary nonfiction writers. I think she's incredibly talented and her books run the gamut. But her first book, I think, at least the one that really put her on the map, is called Stiff. And it's about, the whole book is about what happens when you donate your body, and not to, not for medical purposes in the sense of, you know, getting your tissues or your organs into a living, breathing person who needs those organs to continue to survive, but donating your body to science, figuring out how to learn from it.
So basically what we do.
Exactly. And so, but she covers the gamut, and I'm assuming that you guys do too. But she talks about what happens when they end up in medical training facilities, when they end up in like in the body farm, when they end up for FBI research, they'll use them dropping out of planes for body scatter analysis. Like, there's a lot of stuff apparently that they'll do with your dead corpse, which is really cool because they can learn so much from you.
Yeah, there is an incredible amount to learn. And it's really a very, very fascinating industry. I know I previously was actually in the medical device world, and I've been in the tissue banking world for about a year now. And oh, okay. I feel like it's a never-ending experience when it comes to the possibilities of what we can learn from the human body. And I find that every day I come in and it's, you know, something new. So we live in an ever-changing world, and I think this is an area that people really don't know a lot about. So I think it's, you know, the fact that there's books out there you can read and get more information about the industry is amazing. But I mean, there's so much involved. You know, there's regulatory, there's the idea of ethics, you know, what's acceptable in science and what is not. Mm-hmm. Every day it's a challenge, and it's never boring. So,
yeah. And there's also a lot of these ethical issues, I'm assuming, that come in before you die, ensuring that your wishes are known and respected. So I would love to talk about sort of the start to finish process. Maybe that's a good way to conceptualize this for people who have literally never thought about this before. So you work for a company called MedCure, and MedCure, I'm seeing, is a .org. So are you guys, like, how does this work? Are you affiliated with the government? Are you a nonprofit? Are you an NGO? Like, what does .org mean on a web viewer?
Well, us, we are a for-profit company.
Okay.
We're not nonprofit. There are some nonprofits out there. But I mean, for us, we're in it for the science and the education, and to provide donors for an option. So yeah. First and foremost, you know, we don't compensate people for their bodies in the sense of, like, we're not paying, we're not providing incentives in that sense. The regulations actually don't allow us to do that. What we do is we hear from people a lot of times from word of mouth, because they know someone who's participated in donating their body for science and research. They'll call us up, they'll say they're interested in the program, and we'll run them through, you know, the kinds of things that we do and explain all the potential things that could possibly happen to their body. We don't guarantee any particular, like, education or research when someone's donating. And that's because it's kind of a, you never know what's going to be ongoing and what's not. So there's the expectation that we're going to be looking at someone's medical records, and they're going to need to release those to us. And we're going to try to find the best education or research fit for the donor.
So, oh, sure. Because if you die of a certain cause, or you're of a certain age, or you have a certain ethnic background or a certain blood type, like, you could be more interesting, I guess, to a certain research project.
Exactly. And, you know, we're kind of here to help fill researcher needs. Our organization kind of operates as a bridge between donors and researchers so that confidentiality can be maintained on both sides. You know, you want your research to be blinded when it comes to the people themselves, not their medical traits or their physical traits. From the donor side, you always want to protect donor privacy. So that's one of the things that we take very seriously. When someone comes to us, you know, we make sure that their private information is protected. We get a release of their medical records. They have to consent. One of the challenges at the beginning of the process really is making sure that family members are really aware of your wishes. That's always a struggle.
This is an issue that I have spoken to a lot of people about before, not just for body donation. You know, I have a friend who is a mortician who was on the show, Caitlin Doty, and we talk quite a bit about just this issue of making sure that you know, your next of kin or the people who ultimately might have legal rights know what your wishes are, because there's that fuzzy time when you're dying, especially if you're dying of, you know, so-called natural causes. But even if you die suddenly, where consent is apparent when you are fully competent, and competency can change as the dying process takes place. And so that's something that's really important, right? That like you make these decisions when you're well, and you make these decisions when you're kind of a very clear mind, and you make those wishes known so that there's no, I guess, confusion around that.
Yeah, very much so. One of the big challenges here is making sure that there's no discrepancy among family members and next of kin as to what the donor wanted. And oftentimes people will have an advance directive on file. You know, they'll specify that, you know, in the hospital, do they want to be brought back? Do they want to be placed on machines? But they don't really talk about the end of life as much. So, you know, I tell people after working here, you know, make sure you have a will and make sure you talk to people in your family. Make sure they know where you sit on scientific research, you know, before you get to a point where you are incapacitated. And whenever possible, make sure that you put it in writing. And every state has, you know, different documentation requirements, and there's a lot of variability. So really do your research and think about those things. Because there are a lot of challenges. There are some times when we can't tell from, you know, someone's healthcare power of attorney what their wishes are. And even though we would love to have them in our program, you know, we can't. So it's very specific. And I would just recommend that, you know, people do their due diligence.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. Like, I have some very strong feelings about the American way of death. And I am painting with a broad brush, which is a bit unfair because I know that we are a rich multicultural nation. And there are a lot, I think, of really healthy, really healthful relationships with death that come in oftentimes from other cultures. A lot of rich tradition around death, a lot of deep kind of emotional relationship with it. But in America, by and large, again, sweeping with a broad brush, I do worry that we are very death averse. We're very death phobic. And in many ways, we're just very death denying. So many people just simply don't want to think about these things while they're still alive. But the unfortunate outcome of that is that they leave a lot of it up to their loved ones in a time of tremendous grief and a time of really real inability to make these kinds of decisions clearly. And also, this is really horrible to say, but we know it's true. There are predatory funeral industries out there. And there are individuals that will upsell you and upcharge you and, you know, because your loved one would really want the casket with all the gilding. And it's a really sad time for somebody to have to make those kinds of decisions because they're just vulnerable to making decisions that maybe aren't in the best interest of the financial future of the family or of the wishes of the person who passed. So it's a tough time. And I mean, that's just me making a case for, if you know you want to do this now, why not reach out to a company like Medcure or any company that you're interested in doing it with and start the process early and get this stuff on paper?
Yeah, very, very much so. I agree with you. I think a lot of Americans are very averse to thinking about death. And I will say, for anybody who is considering whole body donation for scientific research and education purposes, if you are looking for that, I would recommend finding an accredited tissue bank. So you said there are some bad players out there, and I've heard horror stories since I've been in this industry. Luckily, none of the people that I've worked with have been associated with anything, you know, as far as I can tell, that would not be considered above board. But there are
similar to like a school and a university where it needs to be accredited by either the state or by the licensing body or whatever. There's an accreditation board for this specific procedure.
Yeah. So we call ourselves NATOs. So we're non-transplant anatomical donation organizations. So right now there isn't like an official regulatory agency that really oversees us. I mean, we follow the Uniform Anatomical Gift Acts, but we aren't really regulated by the FDA to the same degree as like transplant is. So mm-hmm. we have a voluntary accreditation through AATB, which is the American Association of Tissue Banks. And there are okay. probably about, nine NATOs, I think, in the U.S., who kind of submit to this voluntary regulation. And basically, this accreditation says that we have certain things in place. You know, we have practices for maintaining traceability, for doing infectious disease testing, for ensuring proper storage, for ensuring ways of communicating and getting proper consents from donors. So not all organizations are inspected to make sure that they're doing that. So we get audited, you know, on a periodic basis, and all of that stuff is verified on site at our facilities.
Yeah, it's funny. You think about kind of like this sort of clandestine, antiquated past of, you know, med students digging up bodies. And, you know, you hear all these ridiculous stories from hundreds of years ago. But the truth of the matter is, like, maybe that's not going on anymore. But there probably are some. There's so many places where the ethics probably get ambiguous, that making sure that there's a clear protocol in place and that there are agreed upon rules that everybody has chosen to follow. I mean, it makes me feel better to know that yeah. I'd be working with an organization. And you said you're one of nine, so there are options available that I'd be working with an organization that's doing it the right way.
Yeah, I mean, there are good organizations out there. I think some of the horror stories I've heard, and again, I don't know who this is. I've just, you know, rumor mills and things since I've been here, but people mm-hmm. who have storage units with chest freezers in them and they don't, you know, have proper labeling. And I think, oh my goodness, like, yeah. where did you get someone to consent to that? Like, to me, they're just big questions when I hear things like that. Like, how are you even operating? So I don't know who those players are specifically. It's just, it's concerning when you hear things like that. So I would just recommend, you know, when people are out there, that they look for institutions that have the AATB logo.
That's good advice. Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, because again, you know, just like any industry, just like any aspect of our lives, there's tips and tricks and protocols and, like you said, accreditation boards, and like nobody really knows this. And then when somebody dies suddenly, it's like all reason goes out the window, and everybody's desperate to make these really fast decisions. It's great to know that there is there's a protocol that you can follow right now if this is something you're interested in. So let's talk about that protocol. Let's say right now I'm young, I'm 30, I'll be 35 this year. I'm healthy, but I definitely want to do this. So actually, this is great. Why don't you help me figure out how I'm going to go about doing this? And I'm going to do it. Like, this, help me know what to do so that I can do it today.
Okay. Well, we actually have a registry program. So I would say, as a 35-year-old, like, you would actually be a great candidate for organ donation to save someone's life if something happened. But for mm-hmm.
and that's on my driver's license good, here in California. I am interested in that. So maybe that's a quick question. Can I not do both?
You can do both. We often accept people who have donated corneas and things like that. So we are trying to build additional relationships. We're always trying to build additional relationships because there's so much need in the medical industry for tissue. But
With us. And so when we talk about organ, like, you know, on the driver's license, it says organ donor. And that usually I think of is like, you're in the hospital, you know, you get in a terrible car wreck, something terrible happens, and you're what they call a beating heart cadaver. You're brain mm-hmm. dead, basically. So your body is on a heart and lung machine. Your blood is pumping. Your lungs are working because they're being aided to work. And so all your tissue is healthy, but you're not coming back. So then, you know, your heart could go into somebody who's on a heart transplant list, your lungs, your corneas, your, you know, there's all sorts of organs. But there's also this concept of tissue donation, which is very different. And you guys are actually involved
in,
right?
So what would happen, I guess, with our process is you could pre-register with us. You can call us up and mm-hmm. you could fill out forms ahead of time indicating your wishes. So this is a good thing for people who are thinking about their end of life already and want to have a plan prepared for their family. And as part of that registry, yeah. you know, once you've completed those documents, they can give you a little card that you can carry around. So if something happened, you'd have that card on you and the people around you would know that you could call Medicare. So our mm-hmm. donors usually come to us after the time of passing. So if you were an organ yeah. donor, we would get you after all of that had occurred, and our donor coordination team would do, you know, a full review of your medical history, request your medical records, and then we'd, you know, file for a transit permit. You have to have transit permits to transport people across state lines.
Oh, because you don't have a facility in every single state, obviously. That
exactly. We have we have a facility in Portland, Oregon, one in Orlando, Florida, one in St. Louis, Missouri, another in Las Vegas, and another in Rhode Island. So we have a few.
Okay. So wherever you're closest to, you guys would come pick up the body, whether that be, like, let's say I am an organ donor, that would be from the hospital, I would assume, where they've already harvested any organs that they need. That's maybe not a good word, harvest, but
we tend to use different words. We don't like to use words like corpse. We refer to people as donors, because that's what they are. You know, they're giving the gift of research and education and future life. So we want to be respectful in all the words that we use. We call them donors and
treat them like people.
Yeah. And the human side is very, very important. That's something like everyone in the industry takes pretty seriously, because we wouldn't be here if it weren't for the donors, you know?
Yeah. Because this is a voluntary thing. I mean, basically the idea here is that there are medical students all around the country. There are lab researchers. There are government research projects. There are private research, whatever the case may be, where having a donated body is incredibly helpful, whether it's about learning how to do brain surgery or figuring out what stage certain insects develop so that we have better forensic science. But regardless of the process, you need actual dead bodies in order to do that. And so it's up to the people. You can't just take a dead body. It's up to the people to say, I want my body to serve this purpose.
Exactly. They have to come to us and they have to say, hey, you know, I want to participate in this. And actually, speaking of, you know, some of the training that occurs, I actually just got back from a conference and we had a neurosurgeon come in and he had, you know, some incredible things to say that, you know, I hadn't thought of previously. I guess neurosurgeons, like, they do a 7-year residency, and I guess the laws,
it's crazy
long. Yeah, right? The laws have changed. So they used to have like no limits on the amount of hours they could work. So where this gentleman was coming from, there's now legislation in place where they can't work more than like 80 hours a week.
Which is probably good. No, that sounds like
it's a
good
great
thing.
Law, but he made a fantastic point that now they're getting a lot less hands-on practice by the time of their residency. So for him, he wants tissue so he can have these people get hands-on practice in neurosurgery before they operate, you know, on an actual person. And even some of the devices that he was using for surgeries. I think he showed us a surgery he was able to perform with, you know, a very, very small camera and some very, very small tools, where he was able to go in through the nose and remove a brain tumor and pull it out through the nose. So historically, you know, if you go back a generation or so, someone would have had to have their skull completely opened up, and it was a much more invasive process. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we do is providing the means for those new medical devices to be tested and proven and fully validated before they're used in a hospital setting. And then, you know, someone's donation will also allow a doctor to practice those procedures before, you know, they go and do it on a living person. So it's incredible, you know, and when you look at a 7-year residency, I can't imagine being a doctor and spending so much time in school and then spending so much time in a residency and then having to go cold turkey, like where I haven't had as much hands-on experience into someone's brain. Like, the thought of that is frightening to me. So kudos to neurosurgeons.
Yeah, and these are, exactly. These are like some of the toughest, which is why they have the longest residency out there in neurosurgery. This reminds me of a really good book. It's called Another Day in the Frontal Lobe by Katrina Furlick. Ooh. I highly recommend it to anybody who hasn't read it. She, I think at the time of writing it, she was one of only 40 female neurosurgeons in the country, because it's such a demanding training protocol that a lot of women who, you know, are interested in having families just don't do it. They just can't do it because it would kind of really change the course of their family planning. And so it's a really interesting book because it talks a lot about the training involved, but it also talks about her kind of personal emotional experiences with the patients. And it talks a lot about, like, from a feminist perspective, sort of about what it is to be a physician at that high a level and the challenges and the demands and things like that. So yeah, highly recommend it. I love it when my podcast
it sounds like
me
a great
good,
read. I'm probably going to go get it after this. So
yeah, you totally should. It's great. But you have to read Stiff first. Okay, so back to the process. I do want to ask one question that I know will feel a little out of left field, but like, let's say we're at the stage where we're signing paperwork. Either we have a terminal illness, we just think about death a lot, and we know that it's important to make sure that our wishes are known, or, you know, for whatever reason, we've decided that we want to go through this process. We have a registry, or you have a registry, we reach out to you, we register, and we sign all the appropriate paperwork. We know we're competent, and the legalities are taken care of there. But then it's like, okay, what happens when I die? Do I have to pay for this? Or is that, because it sounds expensive.
No. So if you're accepted into our program, there's no payment from the donor family. Again, they're giving the gift, so we cover everything else. You know, we get people to our facilities, we take care of cremation. And at the end of our process, it's kind of nice. I actually get to do these personally, and it's one of the most fulfilling parts of my job. I get to write a letter with a description of the research and education that someone's loved one participated in, and I can send that letter back to them. So yeah,
tell
so
me.
It's we can't give like extreme details. We can't give the names of companies or the names of people, but we do, you know, give a brief description of, you know, you helped with cancer research, or you helped develop, you know, a new dental surgery or a new orthopedic surgery or something like that. So we'll provide that. And I think that really gives families closure, and it's kind of a way for them to leave a legacy. You know, a lot of people ask for those so they can take them to wakes, or they can share them with their friends and family. So it's
Super cool. And isn't it also the case that, you know, somebody donates their whole body, but you don't always use the whole body in the scientific experimentation? Or even if you do use the whole body, you don't quote unquote use it up. Like, the body is left, or parts of the body are left after the scientific experimentation. So can the family get those remains back?
Yeah. So we actually do provide remains back to families.
Oh, cool. And so you take care of the cremation as well?
We take care of the cremation. Yep. And it goes back to the family. So it's really a beginning to end. It's something that we want the whole process to kind of be taken care of, in the sense that, you know, it's a hard time in people's lives and they're doing something really selfless. So they should have to worry about the important stuff. You know, they shouldn't have to worry about that. So.
Well, and that's great too, because that's actually, I mean, it's not the most expensive part of the funerary process, but it is a part of it. Like, again, referencing the podcast that I did with Caitlin Doty, she has a nonprofit funeral service here in Los Angeles called Undertaking LA. And she helps train individuals how to, like, what their rights are with regard to the body. The body is pseudo property. What is healthy? What is, you know, unhealthy? Like, you can keep the body for certain amounts of time. It's totally fine. If somebody dies in the home, you can dress them, you can wash them. Yeah. The same bacteria that makes them smell bad is not going to make you sick, all that good stuff. And she also teaches them, you know, you can do your own funeral. Like, you can have a wake in the home and do a cremation for relatively inexpensive, but it still costs between $900 and about $1,500 to cremate a body. And so that's, you know, for some people, that actually is still a pretty significant burden. So I think it's really wonderful that you guys provide that as part of kind of a thank you for doing such a selfless thing.
Well, I mean, we don't like to say that it's a thank you. It's kind of part of the process. And again, it's not something, we don't advertise it as something to bring people in either.
This isn't like a selling point.
I just mean, the regulations are very clear in the sense that we have to, and obviously I'm coming from quality assurance, so I have to say stuff like this, but.
So you have to cremate any of the remains after they're used.
It is part of the process. I mean, when you think about it, you have dissections and things occurring. And so it's very necessary, you know?
Sure. And sometimes I'm assuming that people are either, gosh, I have no idea, but I would assume that sometimes people are embalmed or somehow fixed for this process. Like, if you're working on a cadaver in a medical school, that there may be some fixing of the tissues to make them last longer. And then sometimes people are not embalmed. And either way, they would still need to be disposed of at the end.
Yeah,
disposed of, quote
unquote. That is correct. And that's one thing, too. You had mentioned earlier, you know, some bad players in the funeral industry. And that's one nice thing. You know, we have people that we work very, very closely with, and we are responsible for making sure that disposition is safe and clean and, you know, and that there are proper line clearances in their systems and all of those kinds of things. So we work with people very closely and make sure that that's done right. You know, just like with entering our program, I'd recommend that everybody make sure they go out and do their research when it comes to a funeral home. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it feels like a burden, but it's so much less of a burden to do these things now. And they're a great resource. I mean, now that we have the internet, everything is easier. I'm looking at your website, for example, and it's so clean and easy. It's like, oh, click here, follow these rules. Like, oh, okay, I can do that checklist, you know, that's nice. But the issue is that this is the best case scenario. This is the easiest case scenario because this is the person whose body is their own making the decision when they are fully competent, when they are alert, when they are young and vigorous and healthy and know that ultimately this is what we want. But what happens when somebody dies who hasn't thought about any of this and it's really up to their next of kin or their caretaker?
Yeah. So their legal next of kin gets to make those decisions. And that's, we kind of talked about it earlier. You know, if you haven't specified to your next of kin what you want, they're allowed to act in what they believe would be your best interest. So under the law, the idea is that they do follow your wishes. But if they don't know what those are, they're going to do what makes the most sense for them. So, you know, it's one of those things, every state has different laws on authority.
Okay.
So it may vary from state to state. And that's something that people can look up to. You know, maybe you don't know what you want and you want someone to make decisions for you. Well, I just verify that, you know, there are people in your life who are available to pick that stuff up. And even if you don't know what you want, that you've designated who those people are.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I know that this is kind of a sensitive topic, but think about who your next of kin is, because we do still have some regressive laws in certain areas that may not, for example, respect the wishes of LGBTQ individuals.
Yeah.
We may have some regressive laws in areas that may not respect the wishes of people who have more of a chosen family than a given family. And also, you may have religious or ideological conflict with your next of kin. And so you need to make sure that if you're afraid that they are going to do something, like let's say you're against embalming and traditional burial because you don't think it's a sustainable practice and it's just not in line with your wishes. And you know that you want to donate your body, but you know that a family member is, you know, maybe religious or for whatever reason with their background, they're against this practice, then you need to make it known that this is what you want on paper, because otherwise they might not give you that gift.
Yeah. And actually, you know, we see these conflicts on a daily basis. You know, if we are unsure what someone wanted or we think the information doesn't add up, a lot of times, you know, we won't accept someone into our program. We want to make sure that we are honoring the donor's wishes and being respectful. So if that's something that we are unable to confirm or there are clear discrepancies, a lot of times it will prevent us from accepting someone's gift, which is, I think, really a tragedy considering the need out there.
And sad for the person, too, because, you know, ultimately, even if you feel very strongly that you know that that's what they wanted, but there's no system or protocol set up to prove that, it's just a loss. It's a loss for the person who has just passed, and it's a loss for all the people who could learn from them.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, especially when you look at some of the things that our donors have contributed to, you know, there are companies out there who are making better pacemakers and perfecting heart valve transplants, and not just medical schools, even, you know, development of new products, better orthopedics. I mean, this is something that I think about. I actually have a family member who is a very fairly tall individual, and he had degenerative disc disease and ended up having quite a few surgeries on his back, partially because some of the devices placed into his back were not appropriate for his size and stature, and it ended up causing him a lot of long-term pain. So every human being is an individual, and people, you know, contributing to a program like this, they're allowing companies that make these things to make better products, to see human variability, and to make sure that those products are applicable to that human variability. And you're not always going to get that with, you know, imaging models and things like that. So if we can't get someone in the door, I see that as a a loss in the sense of future potential for all of us.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank one of the sponsors of this week's episode, Army ROTC. Ready to become a leader? Enroll in Army ROTC. You could get a full tuition scholarship, and you'll graduate a leader and an officer in the U.S. Army. Army officers inspire strength in others. To receive more information about the Army ROTC program, visit goarmy.com/podcast today. Paid for by the United States Army. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
It's also so cool that, like, you know, maybe some of the things that make you unable to donate organs, like because you're really elderly and, you know, your organs aren't as strong as they used to be, or because you have some sort of congenital or genetic illness that makes it so that it's a little too risky, let's say, for your heart to go into a person who needs it. The very thing that might make you ineligible to donate organs could make you a really important and fascinating subject for a research protocol.
Exactly. And we have researchers who look for specific things, you know, mm-hmm. They'll look for disorders and diseases, especially, you know, ones that are common, towards the end of life. So age is something that we don't rule out. Again, yeah. We were talking about before a younger person going for organ donation, but people who aren't eligible for that, this is still a great way for them to contribute and leave something to the world. So,
I don't think people even know that this exists. Like when I say I want to donate my body to science, sometimes people are like, what does that mean? Like you want to give somebody a heart? And it's like, no, to science. And it because I think we're so used to the fact that, you know, in states like California, there you can get the little red donor sticker on your license and you can say, I want to help. But there is no blue donor sticker for people who are like, if I can't help in that way, I still want to help in this way.
Yeah, it is kind of an interesting loophole. That's something that in the industry we've kind of talked about quite a bit too, is, you know, people have on their license that they can donate their organs, but they aren't even aware of the next step. And a big movement right now, I think industry-wide, is to educate the public and let them know that it's an option. Because you're right, a lot of people just don't know it's an option. I remember when I first started working here, kind of explaining to some of my friends and family what this organization was, and they were surprised that it even existed. So I myself mm-hmm. didn't really know it existed. I kept driving by the building and wondering, what is that place? What is that place? And I looked it up and I was just incredibly fascinated and enthralled, and I had to know more. So
Oh, how funny. So you didn't come from like a different sort of quote unquote death industry and then move into this area. What was your background before you started working at Medcare?
I've actually been working in the medical device industry since I graduated from school. I have a bachelor's in biology and, you know, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I went directly into industry after school. And, you know, I worked at a couple medical device companies, you know, doing design controls and getting products cleared mm-hmm. through the FDA. And so I actually have an interesting perspective when it comes to, you know, the need for tissue from the industry side. Yeah. So it's a great fit in that sense. But
it's so cool. And so you said earlier that your specific title is you're the quality assurance manager. So you are, when we say quality assurance, it's like you are making sure, I'm assuming, that the right bodies and body parts are going to the right people.
That, among other things, yes. Yeah. So So first and foremost, infectious disease testing. We want to make sure that anybody coming into the program who's going to be coming in contact with a doctor, you know, a medical student, a researcher, that they're not going to be participating in the spread of an infectious disease. So safety.
Yeah, unfortunately, if you die of Ebola, you might not be the best. That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
So, I mean, there's a degree of screening that happens there. And then traceability is a part of it. Yes, making sure that the right things go to the right places. We actually, vet our customers in the sense that every time, you know, they, I say our customers, researchers and educators, that's a weird way of saying mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, but to you, that would be your customer. Right?
Yeah, so we actually vet them. You know, some organizations, you have, you know, a supply chain and you vet your supply chain. Well, we have to vet our customers. So it's kind of a weird relationship in that sense. But we look...
So you actually will like visit a university, let's say a gross anatomy class to make sure that they're following protocol.
That does happen. And what we're looking for is proper storage conditions, you know, because we want to know that they're treating donors respectful. We want to know that there's a legitimate research or education need, you know. We will not send something to like a residential address. That doesn't happen. I mean, my team, we personally look up every shipment, like we'll look online to make sure that it's a hospital or a research facility and it's not a garage somewhere, you know?
And you also want to make sure that the place that is using these donations are following from the time they receive it to the time they're finished with it. They know who is who. When you're getting the remains back, yep. you're giving the cremains to the appropriate people. Because I could see, I mean... I don't know. I could see, you know, like a really large university getting a bunch of donated bodies being like, whatever, a body's a body. But like, no, you need to know that Jane is Jane from the beginning to the end. Even if by the end she doesn't really look like Jane anymore, you need to know it's still Jane so that the family of Jane can get her back.
Yeah, and there's no exceptions to that either. You know, we do a fair amount of training on the front end too. So if someone in a lab wants any amount of tissue, you know, we run them through the gambit of what the expectations are going to be. You know, you have to keep labeling on. You can't take it off. You can't transfer from facility to facility. If you call us and you say that you need this, you are responsible for it under the law. And if you need anything, if you have any questions, you know, we have people who are here 24 hours a day who are willing to take your call and willing to help you figure something out if you have a research need when it comes to transport or something like that. But they have to run it by us.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So, I mean,
so let's say that they receive a donation and they're doing some sort of research thing and then they realize that the secondary facility could really use the hearts of all of their different bodies or something like that. They need to reach out to you and say, hey, is there a way that we can make this work?
That is correct. And then we'd have to, you know, vet that secondary location and make sure that it has appropriate facilities and all of that. So the quality assurance part is really important. And again, I cannot stress enough, that's the difference between a lot of times an accredited institution and a not accredited institution. So can't stress it enough.
Yeah, obviously that's so important. It's good to know that this kind of stuff is really thought about from sort of, I'm trying to think of a way to put it, from beginning to end, I guess, is from alpha to omega. You know, that's a very good way to put it. Because I think that it's a really cool thing. You know, a lot of people, one of the things that I've really come to realize in my research, and of course, I'm still at the beginning of my journey academically and also practically. But one of the things that I've really come to realize is that death, whether it be dying or actually the death process itself, really is the final stage of growth for a lot of people. It's a life stage, and there's a lot of amazing things that happen around death. And we shouldn't think of it as just like the after or the aftermath or the whatever that's, you know, that's unimportant. There's so much beauty. And there's so much potential, and there's so much like actual, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the right words here, trying to pick them carefully. There's so much sort of actualization, meaning making, and basically just really positive affirmations and outcomes that can come from this stage of life. They can really give life a lot of meaning in these final hours and days and weeks and months. And so it's so great to know that there is this option to even continue on that legacy after you are no longer aware.
Yeah, very much so. And I think you're right. I mean, there are so many different ways of looking at it. And why wouldn't you want to go out giving back, you know, and doing something positive? Mm-hmm. It is beautiful.
It really is. And oh my gosh, I'm loving this. I'm seeing that on your website. It says that when you do donate, all the transportation arrangements are taken care of, a certified copy of the death certificate, the cremation. And I love this, either a return of the cremated remains to the family or a scattering at sea.
Yeah, we do scatter at sea. Some people, you know, they want to be done. They don't want to have to worry about it.
They don't want 12 weeks later, months later getting back, because it can take a while, right?
Yeah.
They have to do the research first.
Yeah, it can take a while. You know, we do offer that as a service, and I'm actually always surprised at how many people just prefer to go straight through all the way to Scatter.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's different, and all the options are there and laid out.
And I love that, too. You know, something that I think I often think about when it comes to death practices, death rituals, and definitely death industry in the United States is that they often are not very individualized. You know, there's sort of, I think there's a sheen of individualization when you visit a large funerary home or you visit a, what do you call it? A burial plot, like a cemetery. And, you know, there's a sheen of like, oh, you can get the rose engraved, or you can get, you know, like I said, the gilded corners. But like, come on, what does that have to do with a person? Oh, grandma would really love those gilded corners. No, like what is grandma really, what really matters to her? You know, what are her deep wishes and interests, and what did she always really care about in life? That is a very individual process. And so it's neat to know that those very personal things are thought about in this whole body donation process.
It's funny that you bring up, you know, the headstones and the burial options at the end. That's actually something that I found very fascinating since I've entered this industry. I know, like, over in Europe, I just learned this recently, that, you know, you get a burial plot and it's not indefinite because there's not enough space for people, right? So a lot of times,
a generation, in a lot of places.
A generation later, they dig you up. And so we have, you know, the option of legacy, you know, in the form of you hearing about the contribution you made without without all of that, not having to worry about a generation later. You know, you get to know that you contributed to science and not that you're, you have a plot for 5 years that may not be there afterwards. So,
You know, I think a lot of times we don't like to think about these things. Obviously, it's very existentially taxing. There's a lot of emotion tied to it. But there's, we think of death as being this very permanent process, sort of like you die and then like, that's it. But you're right. There are procedures in place, like they might dig your body back up and put it in a mass grave. And a lot of times you got to read the fine print on these things. There are things that you think should be legal that aren't legal. In like in Los Angeles County, for example, I cannot have a green burial.
Really?
I can't do it in my county. Yeah. Unless I am buried in a Jewish cemetery, which I would never be able to be because A, not Jewish, B, covered in tattoos. But so unless I were buried in a Jewish cemetery where there are kind of rules grandfathered in, the closest thing that I could have to a green burial is in Joshua Tree. So, you know, to go visit me would be kind of a trek for a lot of people. But I don't want to be, well, I'm going to donate my body to science anyway, so that doesn't matter. But if that, but if that weren't an option, I wouldn't want to be embalmed. I'm really against embalming and just conceptually. And that's not an option in LA, you know? So there's a lot of like, I feel like kind of know your rights and know what the rules and regulations are in the place where you live. Because there's like weird stuff about what has to happen to your body. And the nice thing to know is that there are alternatives, but you have to opt for
them. It's kind of funny too when you talk about opting versus not. And we kind of spoke a little bit earlier about the differences between, you know, the US and some other places. I know England, I guess, opts everybody in to scientific research and education.
Yeah, I think that's cool. And so you'd have to opt out if you decided, no, I don't want to help people.
Yeah, exactly. You have to specify over there that you do not want to participate in future scientific research and advancement. And you have to have it written somewhere, or you automatically kind of go into that pool. And it's funny because we're so, like you said, uptight, or we don't want to talk about death, that we don't have a lot of that stuff on the books. We have a completely different perspective, you know?
Yeah, and it's a bummer too, because it just leaves so much responsibility and stress. Because a lot of times you'll see these, let's say somebody does die, unfortunately, in a car accident. And, you know, they're starved of oxygen for a while from their brain, so they're brain dead, but the rest of their organs are completely healthy and they're on a lung heart machine. And, you know, this is kind of best case scenario. They could donate whole organs to several people. And there's a family member who's like just distraught. They don't know what their wishes are. They don't really understand the process. Something about it freaks them out. They're like, no, I need them to be whole in order to be buried at home. Whatever the reason may be, there's an ideological issue or some sort of spiritual issue. And they miss that opportunity just because in the moment, the decision is too stressful to make. And that's just so unfortunate.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times too, and you know, it's easy for us to talk about what we would do or what we wouldn't do. And I think when you get to that point, sometimes, you know, scientific research seems like a great idea, but then, oh, do I really want to donate my body? You know, what's going to happen to my body? So that's always a challenge too, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's true. I think we're starting to get hip to that in psychological research because a lot of previous protocols in psychological research are like that. If faced with this decision, would you choose column A or column B? And then they started to realize after the fact, it doesn't match up with what actually happens.
Isn't that weird?
Because what people say they're going to do is very different than what they actually do.
Yeah, we want to be altruistic. But I mean, again, that comes down to a lot of your religious beliefs and things like that. And everybody's different. I was actually surprised. I think I was looking online in the what the Catholic Church now actually allows for cremation. Historically, it was not something that they encouraged. But I think in the 60s they allowed it, and it's becoming more and more common now.
Yeah, the Catholic Church is like really
they really are. It's hard not to like them.
Just last week. I know. And just last week he was like, yo, dog, I'm super against capital punishment. So like, I don't think we should be doing the death penalty anymore. And I was like, that's so great. So yeah, that's super cool to know. And I think that is an important thing, right? I come from a much more secular perspective. So I totally empathize with the religious perspective. I have very religious family members and I was raised very religious. So I completely understand the need to respect those types of wishes. But something like donating one's body to science is not, you know, by definition incompatible with
most
religious
definitely
wishes
not.
Either.
I mean, so,
yeah, it's actually quite, I think, altruistic to do.
I would definitely agree.
Yeah. So it's like, that's why it's so important to just know. I know we've said it now. We sound like broken records, but to talk to your loved ones, to be like, sign here. You know, these kinds of things are important, especially I think with an older generation. The boomers are getting older now. And really, their generation may, by and large, be one of the last generations that are completely sort of unwilling or uninterested in talking about these things. I do think we're seeing a sea change, which is cool. But of course, the data have not panned out yet. I don't know if people my age are by and large just going to be much more open about donation or just going to be much more prepared when we die. But I'd like to think so, but who knows? Because the people my age aren't really dying en masse yet. But the boomers are getting up there in age. You know, my parents are getting up there in age. And it's important because culturally, they just don't talk about this.
You know what's interesting about that? We actually did a survey recently, and the millennials and boomers were twice as likely as Gen Xers to donate their bodies to science. So the boomers are actually
weird. So there's this.
Yeah, there is a weird in between. We're seeing quite a few boomers who are coming in as pre-signs and who are interested in our program. But it's the weird in between. So I'm not sure what's going on
that
there.
Is
but.
So funny. That'd be interesting to dig even deeper into. I'm definitely going to talk to my folks about this too, right? Because they're still like totally young and sprightly. They're like, my mom turned 70 this year. And if you're interested in learning from my mama, she was actually a guest on my podcast too. So you can just look up Charlotte Salmon's episode. That's her husband's last name. And she's a great educator. And I think her episode was a lot of fun. It was hard though. It was super weird to interview my mom on my podcast. You know, I feel like talking to our parents, you know, like I said, my mom's turning 70 this year. My dad's a few years younger than her. That's definitely an age where still totally young. She's got so much more life in her. She's, you know, incredibly healthy and works out all the time and she's awesome. But she does struggle with certain things. And it's an age where people have to start thinking about this. So definitely, even if you're not just thinking about yourself, think about the people that are really close to you and maybe don't push them, but maybe ask them. Yeah. What they want to do. Because that's, I don't know. It's important to know.
If life has taught me anything, it's that you never know. So I
yeah, right. And the one thing we do know is we all gonna die. Like we just don't know when. Yeah. That is for sure. That's not gonna change.
But definitely, you know, I'd suggest to people of any age that it's never too late to think about that. So That's not to be dark Absolutely. And morbid, but
nah, I think it's fascinating. I don't like the word morbid because I guess I'm just always morbid. So I assume you're on your registry, are you?
I'm also signed up as an organ donor on my driver's license. I haven't filled out the paperwork yet for anatomical full body donation for science, but I intend to. Coming from a science background.
Yes.
For me, that's kind of a no-brainer. My entire life, I've thought that's the direction I would want to go. So I should be a good example and make sure that I put my paperwork in sooner as opposed to later, you know?
Hells yes. Let's do it together.
Yes.
We can help each other through the process. So, if you're listening, it probably sounds a little bit like Brianna is a little farther away. We had a little bit of an audio issue, but that's fine because we're just wrapping up and we're back. And just don't worry if it sounds like a slightly different connection. Brianna, this has been such a fun chat. I close every episode with the same two questions of my guests. And because of the work that you do, I think I'm especially interested to hear what your answers are to these two questions. And I know that you've listened to the show before, so you might know what's coming. But when you think about the future, I want you to tell me, honestly, A, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing you're a little bit maybe pessimistic about or concerned about? And on the flip side of that, what are you the most kind of hopeful and like legitimately optimistic about? What are you actually really looking forward to and feel kind of positive about?
So as far as what keeps me up at night, I mean, the world is a very scary place sometimes. You know, there's a lot out there that is negative. I have really tried myself to stay positive and be the kind of person that wakes up every morning looking for the good and looking for what I can do to contribute to the world. So I don't know if I can pinpoint one thing in particular. You know, I'm very lucky. I have a great family. I've got two beautiful puppy dogs, and I don't have a lot of negativity in my life right now. I think even working in a place like this, I do have a very healthy sense of mortality. So I think that's really helped me since I've been here, be a more positive person and think about what I can do to make the most of my life on a day-to-day basis and how to live it and enjoy it. And as far as optimism, you know, I think with all the bad, it's nice to see in the world today people speaking up and participating politically and trying to open a dialogue. I think that's the most important thing. You know, we shut down and we become apathetic and we lose so much. So I guess I want to say, be proactive, people, be positive, and don't focus on the rest. Focus on what you can do to make the world a better place. So I know I kind of answered your question. I kind of didn't. But for me, focusing on the good is everything, because if you don't show up to the table, you know, nothing's going to happen. So
absolutely. After my own heart, for sure. And I love what you said kind of about, it's actually a construct in psychology that we often, well, not often, but within my specific little corner, that we call mortality salience, which really is just like, how healthy is your relationship with the fact that you know you're going to die? And there is a lot of really good research that if you think about these things and you confront these things and, you know, you have a healthy relationship with it, that it has psychological benefits across a lot of aspects of your life. It's really the deep denial and the entrenched inability to think about the fact that you're going to die that has a lot of negative consequences. So I think it's really cool that you mentioned that, because like you're really living proof of a concept that's really important that we just don't really talk about enough. So yeah, thank you for that. After my own heart, for sure. So Brianna, before we go, why don't you let everybody know, like it's plug time. Why don't you let everybody know where they can go to learn more about the work that you do and to get involved in this process if they're interested in doing so?
Yeah. So if you're interested in my company, we are MedCure. You can go to medcure.org, look us up online. If you're interested in tissue banking in general, I would suggest, you know, checking out AATB's website. You can actually go online there and you can pull up a list of all the accredited non-organ donation tissue banks, and you can see all of the available options. So look around, find the place that's right for you. And if you have any questions, you know, feel free to call us. We would love to answer questions about our industry or about our program and to share. So medpure.org.
Very cool. Well, Brianna, thank you so much for joining me. This was super enlightening and just, I think, all around for a conversation about death, a very positive one.
I think so.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.